Today, what to do with the wheel Jesus gave you?
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Okay, giving full credit, the today thing today is Daisy's choice. So we're giving the wheel back. This is getting the wheel back from Jesus, though. So the you'll understand why I'm using that analogy in just a few minutes. Today's conversation includes some fairly serious comments, but if you'll hang with me for just a moment, it doesn't take long to get through those comments to understand why they are not the main point, not the thing that identifies what we actually have to talk about today. But they force us to it. They force us to recognize what we do need to talk about. So there are things in my mind and my heart and my soul and my life right now, like in a lot of people's, that are just sad. I mean, that's the response I have. I see people right now that are super angry and other people that are extremely anxious. And there are a lot of, and they're all, you know, emotions are just emotions. You just have what you have. That's fine. But those are not my responses. And I've had them. I've been through all that over the last 30 years. I talked you through my political background and all the things I thought about in every election cycle since whatever. And so I'm not going to rehash any of that. But where I am now is sadder than anything else. Disappointed. Not in the political situation, not in the things that are happening in Washington, D.C. or in public policy or something like that. I think most of us will probably be surprised at the good and bad that comes out of all this stuff. It's not that. What I'm sad at has a lot to do with the things I thought were going on in people's minds, the things I thought we shared in common, and that I've come to realize we didn't, that we just didn't think about in the same way. And it's left me with a void. It's like I lost a good friend or something like that. So to get there, I do want to bounce off of some of the political stuff that's going on right now for just a minute, so you'll know why I'm talking about all of this. So for instance, just an example, because I get Apple News and stuff like that, and my wife will buy me the New York Times every once in a while, hard copy kind of thing. I see all these articles, you know, come out, and they've all, and The Atlantic has quite a few articles out lately having to do with what's going on in D.C. right now, and especially with the new administration and especially Elon Musk and the things he's doing, eliminating positions in the federal workforce and so on like that. And so one of the articles I read was by Ann Applebaum. Daisy, you will be happy to know that Ann Applebaum, by the way, also wrote the introduction to the most recent version of The Human Condition by Hannah Arendt, of course. So anyway, Ann Applebaum, you know, she's got to be a class person. She wrote that introduction. So she writes articles for The Atlantic. The Atlantic is, you know, it's good writing, y'all. I mean, people who write for that magazine are smart. And you can disagree with them if you want to, but you can't say they're not smart, thoughtful, and often very conservative people who are just not happy with what's going on right now. Not all of them are, and there are different opinions given there, but there's a lot of that pushback against the current shape of the conservative movement. And so in this article, it's called There's a Term for What Trump and Musk Are Doing. This is the name of the article that already came out February 13th, 2025, a couple of weeks ago now as you're listening to this. And it's called, and the subtitle is How Regime Change Happens in America. So you can look it up and read it for yourself, see all about it. And the thing I'm mentioning about that article is not that article. It's not unique. There are a bunch of things that talk about it. And in that particular article, the seriousness of what's going on comes down to the replacement of career civil servants with party loyalists. And historically, creating governments, and I have talked about this in previous episodes, there's a difference between a government and a state. There's supposed to be a difference between those two things. And when you start eliminating the difference between those two things, you create an unstable society and an unstable political environment. And that's where we are right now. We're eliminating. It's not just because of the current turn. It's been happening for the last few decades. We've been getting more and more partisan in our bureaucratic administration of what the government is enacting in policy because of its political election. So anyway, the point is, in this article, there's a revelation of the seriousness with which some people are taking this significant turn that's going on in government right now. And so, you know, the indication of how seriously people are taking it comes up in the type of language we're throwing at each other. Again, I've done an episode on the previous four decades of politics, talking about how catastrophism is built into our way of describing every election. But there are catastrophes, you know, so I'm not trying to say nothing bad can happen either. But when terms like authoritarianism and oligarchy and nationalism and so on are becoming common parlance in our discussion of politics, then you realize how seriously people are examining the things that are going on and saying, this is not right. You know, it might be doing more damage than good in the end. Maybe. The terms are there, though, and that's definitely how people are taking it. And just consider, even if you disagree with all of them, just consider how many articles and documentaries are now coming out about conscientious objectors in Nazi Germany or in Europe during the Nazi occupation. That makes you realize how people sense what's happening right now in Washington, D.C. and the federal government. And in some senses, the concerns are legitimate. I mean, replacing career civil servants with party loyalists, that would be the action of a corrupt government. Is that exactly what's happening? Honestly, I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. I'm not sure the people who are doing it know whether that's what's happening or not. And there is, like I mentioned, a difference between government and state that I think ought to be maintained. But, you know, that's a lecture for a different day. In other senses, and this is the part where I know I'm more sad than I am panicked or concerned. In other senses, there's a way in which we're jumping the gun to say this is, you know, fascism enacted in America and so on. Because, I mean, just to put it bluntly, we're not having summary executions yet. Nobody's being dragged out of the building and shot in the street. Now, it's bad enough that that's the test I'm putting out there to say, well, it's not that bad. You know, I mean, I'm not sure where I would go less than that to give you a test to say it's not that bad. But it's not that bad. And that is what was happening then. So thank heavens there is some difference, you know, in what's going on. None of that changes the fact that I'm saddened by what I see happening in our political rhetoric, and I mean from our political leaders, but I also mean from us and the way we're talking about it. And I'm also saddened in some ways because it's like losing an old friend, and not, I don't just mean losing my political friends. Like, I used to hang out with that guy, but he voted for Trump, so I'm not going to hang out with him. I don't mean that. What I mean is I used to talk about politics all the time, and it was like my other buddy, you know, that I could hang out with. And now I kind of have to put myself arm's length from it because it doesn't seem like the same animal that I used to have. Now I never know when it's going to turn around and bite me in the head. And so I don't have it anymore. And so I sometimes get a little critical of myself. And in some cases, I think I receive criticism from others. Nobody really gripes at me about it. I don't think anybody cares. But I mean, I receive it as a criticism in a little way where it's like, why aren't you talking about this? Why don't you say more about this? And I even think to myself, why don't I talk about it more like Sharon McMahon? You know, I listen to some of her stuff, and my wife listens to it all the time, and I've heard of other people who listen to it all the time. And she's really good. I mean, she's smart. She's got some great history knowledge. She's America's teacher. I don't know. I'm sure you've heard of her, and you've heard of her podcast. She's super popular. Why don't I spend more time doing what she's doing? And you know what the answer to that question is? It's really basic. And I'm happy with this, totally happy with this. It's right. But it took me a long time to come to the realization of how fundamentally important it was, not just to what I do and don't do, but to what we ought to have as our aim. The reason I don't do it is because that's not my calling. I mean, it's not like I can't do other things that are not my calling. It's not my calling to drive, and I drive. You know, I don't have to shop, but I shop. It's not my calling to control politics, to fix politics, to make things happen politically. You can say it is your calling. That's fine. But I mean, because I am called to Christian ministry, because I was called to give my life up, to do things to follow Jesus, but also to help other people figure out how to follow him, to follow his teachings, to follow the things the scriptures say. That's my calling. I had to refocus on just that. And I don't mean by that withdraw from the rest of the world, but I mean understand that the purpose is different. I had, so let me put it in the context of that wheel I talked about, you know, Jesus giving the wheel back to you. I had a good friend back when I was in high school and then later in college. Yes, I went to high school before college, just to be clear. I had a good friend who told me a story one time about, and it, you know, this is exactly how he told me. I'm not going to give you the full length version. That would be almost 30 minutes probably. But the short version of this, the exact story that he told me was that he, you know, how you wake up sometimes and you just can't figure out where you are. I had the flu last week, by the way. And so this happened to me a couple of times. Somebody would call or do something and I, it would be in the middle of the day, but I would wake up and not know where I was. I was just terrible. I was completely lost. So he said, you know how you have that feeling sometimes you wake up and you just don't know where you are. So I woke up, he said, and I didn't know where I was. And I was, you know, my head was moving a little bit, and I realized I was looking straight up at the ceiling. I figured I was looking at the ceiling, but all I could see were these little black dots, and I just couldn't make sense of it. It's like, where am I? What's going on? And then the more I thought, the more I realized, and back in our day, again, he was telling me this in high school, we were in college by then when he was telling me about it. But back then we had these perforated ceilings in cars, you know, they had a headliner that was actually perforated so you could see these little black dots. And so he said, you know, I realized that's what I was looking at. I was looking at a perforated ceiling. It's like, why would there be a perforated ceiling? Oh, I'm in a car. I wonder who's driving, you know, I wonder who's driving the car. And then he realized he was the driver of the car, and he was driving through the middle of a field. You know, he'd driven off the road, and he was just out in the middle of the field. Fortunately, there was nothing that he hit, nothing that got between him and, you know, the end of the pasture that he was in by the time he finally hit the brakes and realized what was going on. Nobody wants to do that. You know, nobody wants to wake up and realize you were asleep at the wheel. But I think because we don't realize what wheel has been put in our hands, we are that way. We've just taken our hands off the wheel. We aren't doing the thing we've been called to do. And so I want to get there in three steps. This is a one-shot episode. We're not going to make it two parts. It's going one show. Because it's a fairly direct contrast. And so I'm not trying to paint a logical contrast here. I just want you to observe the path that I think your mind has to follow to get there. One is, first, the step that we have to have if we're going to have faith, and I do. I believe in God. I believe God's sovereign. I believe it so much that I've learned not to try to control things that are not really under my control. And I think one of the most beautiful passages in the Bible that makes clear just how in control God is and how not in control we are, is Psalm 127. I've talked about it on here before. We've talked about it as a sanctity of life issue before. It is given in the context of children being born, but Psalm 127 is not about children being born. It's about everything we do in life, all the work we do, the houses we build, the security we provide, the way we secure our city. All of those things are being described in it. And what it says is, we do all this work. So you know Psalm 127, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord keeps the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. Quoting the King James, you can tell I'm reverting to my quotations instead of actually reading it. It's vain for you to rise up early and go to bed late, to eat the bread of sorrows. And he gives his beloved sleep. So we use that just to say a person's going to sleep. And again, I'm not going to try to exposit the whole psalm to you. It's a magnificent psalm. We're going through the psalms. Hey, in 40 psalms, I'll do it with you, okay? I've just finished 88. When we get to 127, we'll go line by line. But the gist of the psalm is this. When it says, unless the Lord builds the house, you're wasting your time trying to build it. And unless the Lord watches over the city, there's no point in you trying to watch over the city. You're rising up early in vain. You're going to bed late for no reason. Because if God's not doing it, it's not going to get done. The first two, and it's not even two full verses, just a verse and a half. They basically just say that. And then the second verse closes with this line. It's translated as, for he gives to his beloved sleep. But it's not just he lets you sleep. There's something that happens in your sleep. So here you are working and toiling and rising up early and going to bed late. But this is what God does. He gives you sleep. And then what happens in your sleep? And then the last half of the psalm changes entirely to the thing that actually brings security to your city, which in the end of verse 5 is, blessed is the man who has his quiver full of children. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. And again, it's not about reproduction. It's not about having children. It's about this, that he's saying, look what God actually does with you that provides security for your children. He does while you're asleep. You're not doing anything. You're completely out. You get up early and you think, oh, I'm going to secure my city. And God looks at you like you think you're keeping your city safe. Oh, come on, give me a break. You're doing all of this work early in the morning, late at night, and so on. And when does the most, when a person has children, they think that's the most important thing that's ever happened to them. So he says to them, when did the most important thing that ever happened to you happen to you? It's when you went to sleep. You went to bed. Everything's fine. Oh, we're going to wake up tomorrow. It's just going to be me and you. And you wake up tomorrow and wham, you're pregnant. You got children coming. There's no microbiology. There are no microscopes. There's no comprehension of what's going on. It's just this miraculous thing God does to allow people to have children. And how did you participate? You went to sleep. That's what you did. And God gave you a child. The point in that psalm is that our faith is the only thing we bring. The point to that psalm is that the only thing we bring into it is our faith. We're completely passive in the process of this miraculous thing God does to provide all of the stuff that we thought we were going to be able to do with all of our great planning and work and effort and so on. Okay, that's faith. The opposite of that, the side that most of us want to live in, is the agency side, that we actually do stuff. And what we do matters. That's what we mean by agency. What you do makes a difference. You know how important that is to me. It's easy for me to talk about agency. I believe in a free will. I think agency is a huge part of what it means for us to be humans and not just a plant in the world. We're not just a stage play that God is putting on. He's created living creatures. And he gives us this dominion and dignity that comes with agency. I don't know why. But he did, and I'm glad he did. So what is that agency, and why would it be appropriate? I mean, if you look at the Proverbs that you have, the fool is the one who lies on his bed in the house and makes an excuse for not going out and doing things. Oh, there's a lion in the streets. I shall be slain. We're supposed to get out and do stuff. We're charged with the responsibility to do things. It's a sloth, a lazy person, an excuse maker who doesn't do those things. At the same time, when you talk about Nebuchadnezzar in his garden boasting about all the great things he has done, God turns him into a beast, an animal, to say, how much did you do? You know, it's not a complicated lesson. You are no better than an animal to me. Now, that doesn't mean Nebuchadnezzar didn't have agency in the things that brought about the building of Babylon, but it did mean he needed to rethink how he thought about what that agency was or what made it so important. And so the dilemma that we're given, and this is the point to be direct, the dilemma that we're given or left with is the question, what's the point of agency? If the greatest things we can accomplish are accomplished by God while we are effectively asleep. If you just give up, let God do stuff, well, a plant can give up and let God do stuff. So what's the point of me saying, oh, I've got some role in this? Well, your role is not doing anything. So what on earth am I supposed to do with this? I'm supposed to have agency. There's some importance to it. He's made us to have dominion in the earth. He's given us authority and responsibility. He has, in the words of Jesus quoted the Old Testament, made us gods. Now, I don't mean that in the sense that some people take it, but you know what Jesus is even getting at there. So he's given us agency and at the same time said, but just trust God. So what's going on? And I think the way we're supposed to first address that, and this becomes fairly obvious, is to understand the specific domain of our agency. That is, where are we supposed to act? How are we supposed to act? What are the things that we do that actually do make a difference? So, for instance, if you want to talk about agency in the Old Testament in the most obvious passages possible, you listen to the if-thens, the curses, and the blessings that come when Israel, for instance, is going into the Promised Land. If you obey me, if you keep my commandments, if you do the things that I have commanded, then I will bless you with this and that and this and that. And if you do not, then I will curse you and death will follow you and so on. I'll cast you out of the land. And you know the whole story. There's agency in that, no doubt. And the agency is pretty direct. It's all moral obedience. If we're the people, and he describes specifically what those things are for us, so we could talk about what they are without having to go through 532 or however many commands you want to go through in the Old Testament, or even naming 10 commandments in the Old Testament. You just say, walk justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God, do the things that are right. All the things that God has always said we're supposed to be doing. Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself. It's pretty basic, right? Just do the stuff he tells us to do. If you do what I've commanded you to do, then I'll bless you. If you don't, I will curse you. We have agency in that realm. We'll talk more about it in just a second, just to give an example of it. In contrast to that, you read a proverb like the first three verses of Proverbs 21, which is actually pretty extensive, but included in that is, the king's heart, it's like a river of water. The Lord turns it wherever he wants. He makes it go wherever he wants. Well, you could take that just to mean the decisions that he makes in, like Pharaoh. Do I accept or reject the Lord's commandment? Or you could take it to mean specifically, wherever this kingdom's going to go, the king can think, oh, I'm just acting on my own. But in reality, there's a sovereign above that king, and he's the one that's going to bring it to pass. So there may be a domain within which, in the world, the things that are happening are not as much in our control as we think they're in our control. And again, I'm not even saying we don't have any agency in that. I'm just saying I'm not sure that's the agency he wants us to have or he wants us to exercise. So what would I mean by that? Okay, so the way of clarifying it, I think, maybe making it as clear as I can make it anyway, is just by talking about it in terms of power. Because the other day I was making the comments that, when we're quoting Lord Acton and saying, we think power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely kind of statements, that's not really an all-encompassing understanding of what's going on with power, because everybody has power. There are always power in disparities. Somebody's always a little stronger in a relationship and they exercise. The question is whether they're exercising it for their own benefit or for the benefit of others. That's always the question. So the other question that I want to put with that in this case is, why is it that in so many cases we do associate power with corruptions? With the corruption of the people who exercise the power. And it's, I think, for a really obvious reason. So systems, which we all live in, and systems are just, you know, the things that operate every day, the way traffic flows and the way your job functions, the way you have the same argument with your teenager every day, whatever it is. Systems are designed to keep us functioning within them. And when I say, you know, designed to keep us functioning within them, I don't mean designed by their human architects. You know, I think I can design a labor system that will keep the laborers opiated with religion. You know, it's not, that would be ridiculous. It's the nature of, and again, I've done an episode on this too, the nature of structures and systems, that they automatically build up a scaffolding around us that just keeps us where we are. Because that's where we were comfortable. That's where we landed. That's where we started functioning. That's where we're going to keep functioning. So our design is just to keep on doing the same thing. And so when a system feeds into something that's not healthy or helpful to some or to all or whatever, it's going to continue to feed itself unless something from the outside of it breaks the system. It's just how systems function. So what's really fascinating is that systems that don't fix themselves, they just won't fix themselves. What's fascinating about this is that Jesus doesn't show up in the world. You know, here's Jesus, the one who God and man does show up in the world, but doesn't show up in the world to fight the system, which is the thing everyone hopes he'll do. Look how corrupt Herod the Great is. Look how, I mean, he tries to kill Jesus when Jesus shows up. That's how corrupt this man is. Everything is terrible about the system that Jesus is born into, and Jesus doesn't fight the system. It's not what he does. He doesn't overthrow the system. He's not raising a ruckus or being a rebel, even when the people think, this is the guy, we need to crown him king now. He just passes through their midst. He's not going to participate in the system in that way. And instead, he's exercising something completely different. Like I said, from Micah 6:8. So we know we're supposed to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. So justice, mercy, humility. Those things are the same in every context. That's, I mean, justice is justice. Mercy is mercy. Humility is humility. It's the same in every context. And so if you take, for instance, the system of sacrifices that's being offered, and you find somebody who says, oh, well, we need to have more sacrifices, and we need to make it so these people have to offer sacrifices in the right way, then you have people cheating people out of money and figuring out how they can maximize the profits for their own business and so on, and none of that changes the meaning of justice, which is being neglected by abusing the people who are trying to bring their sacrifices to the sacrificial system. None of that changes the meaning of humility, which is not me exalting myself or making myself more important, or I'm the priest to bring me something worthy of sacrifice, but instead humbly serving. Well, allow me to do something for you. And none of it changes the meaning of mercy, which is the point when over and over God demonstrates, says literally the words that he prefers. And by the way, this is present in Proverbs 21 in the third verse. By the Proverbs 21 is the one that said the Lord turns the king's heart wherever he wants it to go. But then just a couple of verses later in a line of verses that appear to be attached to each other, he says he prefers mercy to sacrifice, or righteousness, or justice to sacrifice. This is what he wants. He doesn't just want us to follow the system. Oh, we have the sacrificial system. Just keep the system going. Whatever you have to do to keep that system flowing, that's how God told us we're supposed to. What God wanted was not the system, not the sacrifice, but the mercy. And he tells us that constantly, and it's something we can do. So how am I answering the question, why is power associated with corruption? Well, take it back to politics for just a second and think about the greatest action George Washington ever took. Now, I know it is extremely debatable, and I know you could also make an argument for it just being a pragmatic consideration of an older man trying to get out of politics, whatever. But the reality is everybody wanted him to keep on ruling, and he had the power and the privilege to keep on ruling. But in 1797, when everybody wants him to consider being, you know, another term as president, he declines to be considered for another term. No, not going to do it. And he steps down. We know how important it is that that took place rather than just replacing King George with another President George, you know. We got this instead sort of self-sacrificing system of civil service. That was the goal. That was the object. I'm not saying every president's been a self-denying and humble servant of the people. That's absurd. That's ridiculous. But I am saying there's been an element of that supposedly built into it. And why is that such an important action for George Washington? I mean, the man founded the country in so many ways. But that action sort of tops them all for us to understand that it wasn't about gaining the power to control what the country would look like, but instead actually exercising the agency that he had to step away from that and to allow the moral influence of his decision to be the most important thing that happened. Once we think it's our job to control outcomes in this world's functioning, then we have to take our hands off the one real task that has been given to us. I'll give you more detail on that in a minute. I mean, you understand what I'm talking about. It becomes inevitable. This is the reason power is associated with corruption. If our target is controlling the outcome of the world's functioning, then it becomes inevitable because of our lack of control over everything. We don't have, I don't know if you've noticed it, but we don't have it. Because of our lack of control over everything, it becomes inevitable that to get one thing to go the right way, we have to make other things go the wrong way. It's compromising turtles and rationalizing elephants all the way down, to stretch a Hindu proverb, right? All the way down to what? You know, just think about it. All the way down to the miserable morass of this place we create for others by making bread from stones because we're hungry, or questioning the limits of what we're given because we've learned to abuse those limits, to go past them, bowing down to another god because, well, you know, by doing that, we can gain the power to do anything we need for the greater good. I mean, you hear the temptations of Jesus. It's the whole nature of it. It doesn't matter if you tell me, oh, you'll give me authority over all these things. He's Jesus. That's what he's Lord over all that stuff. Okay, you make me Lord over all this stuff, and I can skip the hard steps here. Let's get the end result. That's not what Jesus is here for. That's not what he does. But it is what we do. And it makes sense of why so much corruption is associated with what we do when what we're trying to do is actually control the outcome. And I wish I could point you to exceptions. I wish I could just point you to exceptions and say, oh, no, here's somebody who committed themselves as a Christian to the public community's good, and they wanted to see a good political outcome, and they never had to compromise their moral convictions. Now, everybody compromises. I'm okay with compromise. I'm okay with political compromise. I'm okay with people getting together and figuring out what the best solution is, not the perfect solution. I'm great with all that. That's not what I mean by compromise. I mean compromising your moral convictions. I wish I could just point you at somebody and say, oh, yeah, no, they never did that. They never lied. They never deceived. They never turned back on a promise. It just didn't happen with them. I'm not saying it's happened with everybody because I don't know everybody. I don't know all the examples. But, man, I have known a lot. Oh, man, do I wish I could point at an example. Why can't I? Why so often do you see the story of the perfect person going into politics? And it's not even just about politics. We do the same thing in business if we've decided that the business outcome is the only thing that matters, that that's what we're going to get. Then the compromise is going to come. The moral compromise is going to come because we don't have control over all the outcomes. And so we start taking all the pieces and we start moving them around and we say, I know I'm not supposed to put that piece over there, but it's the only way I can get this piece here, and I need to have this piece here. And this is more important, so I've got to do this one, and I've got to just break the rule on that one. Just got to break the rule on that one. Why do we have to do that? Well, that's why, you can see, that's why corruption would follow power if our goal is controlling outcomes in the material world. Our goal is controlling the way things are going to function in this world. And I get it. That's what human beings do. That is the nature of the system we live in. There's no way we're not going to be like that unless God intervenes. Thank heavens he did. But we don't always follow the intervention. And so that's what I'm trying to remember in my own life and encourage you to consider in, questioning which wheel is in your hand. So, what's the wheel I'm talking about in our hands? It's pretty simple. It's the moral wheel. You know, we have a moral wheel in our hands. And there are a thousand ways. A moral wheel, this is not as simple as moralism. I'll come back and say more about that in a minute. I don't mean that. Well, if you just do these four things right, if you just tell all those wicked people they're wicked, I'm not saying that at all. It's got nothing to do with that. The thing I was talking about before, justice and mercy and humility, the things Jesus actually names as the moral imperatives, loving your neighbor as yourself, that kind of imperative is what I'm talking about. That wheel's in our hands. You have a choice. This is why Paul is saying, as much as the wheel is in your hands, live at peace with all men. He doesn't say wheel, but that's the point. As much as it lies within you, be at peace with all men. That's in your power. You don't control the Roman Empire. You don't control all the things that are coming from it. You say, yeah, but we're in a democracy. Oh, yeah, and in a democracy, you have control over the outcomes. That's why people start quibbling about whether, was that election legitimate or not? I want to control the election outcome. We're not in control of the outcomes at all. We contribute our piece. We do what we can. And then we say, but you know what? The king's heart. And I don't care whether the king is one man like David or if it's the whole population like in a democracy. The king's heart's in the hand of the Lord. He'll turn it where he wants. I can't do anything about that. But I do have something I can do something about. I know that's pretty broad there. But I can do it something about that something. What's the something? It's moral. That's the point. And there are a thousand ways for us to change everything by simply making the commitment neither to turn to the left hand nor to the right, to use the language of Joshua and Moses, when God says it to them. Just think of it this way. If I'm refusing to be turned by the bullies that I'd like to hit on the shoulder of the road, or driven to rage by the tailgaters that are behind us, or lured away by the constant invitation of cheaper and hotter meals at the next exit, if I can keep my hand on the wheel, keep the wheel aimed at the road, and keep going down the straight road that God has given us to drive on, it's amazing how many ways I can actually make the difference God wants me to make in the world, which is not simply a material end. God owns the cattle on a thousand hills. We just talked about that. It's not like he's needing us to hunt down money to make things happen. He just wants us to be obedient to the things that matter to him. And those things weren't material. If they were material, then he would have given us a Savior that told us how to have the material success that our Savior did not pursue. He instead pursued a cross. So, it happens in so many different settings. I'll mention some of these just to get the ball rolling in your mind for where I'm talking about. But I'll put it in the setting Jesus gives it. If someone slaps us on the cheek, at work, someone insults you, they insult your work, they don't give you credit for it, they take your job and they credit it to themselves. Look what I did. And it was really you who did it. And you don't get credit for it. At home, you're insulted by somebody when you're at home. You expected something to happen and the opposite happens. Or from somebody who's above you, your boss mistreats you. From somebody who works for you, a subordinate is insubordinate. Or you just run into resistance in the people that you're dealing with, whatever it is that's going on. How are you supposed to respond to that? Well, materially, you want to respond to it in the system. And so you keep the system going. Oh, they hit me, I'm going to hit back. They criticize me, I'll fight back. They made an argument, I'll argue back. I don't even know how not to do that. I'm working on it, though. 1 Peter 2, man, perfect description of what this means from the Christian perspective. For to this you've been called. I mean, give serious thought to what this means, because I can't, without just breaking down, I cannot adequately communicate to you how saddened I am by, I guess disappointed is a better word, by the choices that people have made when I thought they knew better, they understood better, they had the same kind of understanding of things that I had. And I'm not even presuming that I'm omniscient about these things, but I'm saddened that I didn't actually share the same kinds of ideas and values that I thought I did with other people. I can't even begin to tell you how saddened that makes me. And yet at the same time, when I remember this, it's like, why was my hope in that? Well, why did I allow myself to get distracted by that? Not because those things are unimportant. They're incredibly important. But man, I'm called to Christianity. I'm called to Christ. And I'm called to this thing in Scripture that I actually think does make a difference. And even if I weren't a believer, I would be looking at the Bible and looking at the history of Jesus and the history of Christianity and going, man, how did that thing make such a difference? Not how did it play into the hands of the politics that it became later. I mean, how did that thing turn into something that was turning the world upside down? And I'd be considering Peter's words here when he says, for to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example. This is not just suffered for you to redeem you, atone you from your sin, and make you innocent again. This is suffering for you to leave you an example so that you might follow his steps. He committed no sin. There was no deception in his mouth. When he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. He didn't fight back. When he suffered, he didn't threaten in return, but continued entrusting himself to the one who judges justly. He said, look, the outcome is in my Father's hands. So you can judge me. You can pronounce all you want to judge on me, but I know what my Father will do with it in the end. So you do what you want to do, and then you'll see me when I come back. That's how Jesus approached it. And you know he did that through his entire ministry. People are begging him to do more. They are begging him to take over. They're begging him to run Rome out of Israel's land. And he doesn't even think about it. It's not his calling. And his calling is our example. By the way, it's not about pacifism. I'm not against pacifism. I'm not for pacifism. I'm not arguing either way about it. But it's not about that. This passage has nothing to do with saying, well, therefore you can't punch people if they're trying to hurt someone. It is the opposite. Oh, by the way, it's also not about passivism, which is, you know, it's not the same thing as pacifism, but it's this confused cousin of pacifism where people just don't do anything, where you just stand back and let nothing happen. Jesus is the opposite of pacifism. He is also not about pacifism. That's just not the point here. I'm not saying, again, that pacifism is wrong. There are arguments to be made for Christianity being pacifist. It's fine. But he is the only one, and this is what Peter's getting at in this passage, he's the only one acting in a system designed to perpetuate everything already happening into exactly the same always happening in the future. He's the only one actually doing something. That's what I mean by the word acting. He's not just behaving. He's not just following the stimulus. He's not just responding to the things that are happening around him. He stands like this rod of steel in the middle of everything else moving, and nothing changes what he's going to do. That's who he is. Strike him, and he stands, and he just takes it. Curse him, and he offers no curse in return. Not because he has nothing to say, not because he's afraid, not because he's a pacifist, but because that's not what he's here for. He's not here to be the standard of how to fight against wickedness. He is. But how do you fight against wickedness? By doing justly, loving mercy, walking humbly with your God, which is what he does all the time. It's why the blood goes into the ground and it cries. This is one of the most prominent meta stories, meta narratives in the entirety of Scripture. Why the blood, you know, starting with Abel, why the blood goes into the ground and cries out for more blood to go into the ground until one who spilled no blood in his life, did nothing to anyone, he harmed no one, who spilled no blood, forgives those who spilled his, and then changed everything about history. That's the break in the cycle. When someone has their hand on the moral wheel that God has given us and says, no, I'm going to drive straight down the road that God put in front of me. I know I'm tempted to go that way because I could solve a problem. I know I could make it look more successful over this way. I could fix these other problems down the road over there if I go that way, but God gave me this road and he said, tell the truth. He said, love those who are not lovable. He said, do the right thing in this moment and leave the results in his hands. It's what Jesus did and it's what he asked us to do following his example. That's what we're able to do if we have the wheel in our hand. I've told you a story a long time ago, and nobody's going to remember this, so I'm going to tell you again. That I had this deacon named, his name was Johnny, and he came into my office when I was a very young man, and he was rightly correcting me about something I'd done wrong in church. I had criticized some people that didn't deserve criticizing. And I'd been, you know, I'd made fun of them. And I, you know, they had spoken in the morning, and that evening I just kind of made fun of them for what they did. And I'm embarrassed that I did it. But at the time, I just thought it was funny, and I thought everybody else thought it was funny, and, you know, it was a way to just play off my personality in the church. And so I thought it was fine. I was the pastor of the church at the time. And I don't like to tell stories where I did the right thing. I did the right thing in this case, but I'll tell you why I'm telling you this story. In this one, the right thing so profoundly came from somewhere other than me. I mean, even while I was speaking the words that I'm about to tell you came out of my mouth, I was speaking the words and I was completely and utterly stunned that they were the words that was coming out of my mouth. And I meant them. I meant them and I had no idea where they had come from. It's like, but by the time it was done, it was like, I'm so glad those are the words that came out of my mouth. So he says, I just don't think you should have said this. Deacon, he was reluctant to come. I could tell he was nervous about coming. And he said, I don't think you should have said that. And I just think it was wrong. I don't think you should criticize people like that. And all I could tell him was, you know, I think you're right. I think that was a mistake. And I'm really sorry I did that. And again, I would never have said those words. Not even in a million years, I would have said to him, look, man, I understand it probably made you uncomfortable, but I mean, what they were doing was wrong, and I felt like I needed to put it in blah, blah, blah. I'd have found a dozen ways to justify it. I still could. And it would have been completely wrong. But I think by the grace of God, sometimes he just sticks these things into you and goes, I'm going to make you better. You need to be better. That's not good enough. And so he just made me different that day. And I wouldn't have found that response if I'd been thrown together with it in a telephone booth and left there for a year. I would never have found that response. And that's what came out of my mouth. Thank you, God, for that change. My point is that that's what you are in this world, where everybody's kicking and scraping and lying and cheating and cutting a corner and making a way to compromise their morals so that they can get to this result that we got to get to. I mean, after all, we got to solve this problem over here. That's how the entire world functions. And God's grace being present in you makes you a piece of God's grace present in this world so that when people are just hurling by in this flood that's taking them over a fall, when they're hurling by, you are this one stump sticking out of the water that they can put a hand on and go, whoa, what is that? Well, where did that come from? And it's completely different. It changes everything. That's who Jesus is in the world, and that's who he invites us to be. It's not simple moralism. It's simple moralism, you know, just follow the 12, you know, the 10 commandments, make sure you don't do any of this stuff wrong over there in that category or that. It's not that. That ignores dilemmas and the real complexities of life. We've talked about that on these episodes plenty of times. But it is replacing the stuff that we planned to change with the thing we actually ought to commit ourselves to. We replace what was political and economic and external and material with the relational and the moral and the internal and the spiritual. And so what I'm recommending is pretty simple, that we not try to drive the car by the dashboard. You know, I want you to turn. You know, it's not going to do anything. That's how we are when we're trying to control the outcomes of the material world. You say, no, I think I'm pretty good at it. Yeah, you're pretty good at it by letting go of the one wheel that God actually gave you. But that's why when we take the wheel God actually did give us, the moral wheel, the one where we exercise justice and mercy and humility, where we demonstrate love, not just sacrifice. So that is my encouragement, that we take control of the moral decisions that we make every day. And I'm including me in that.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.